the show. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. I am filling in for Lisa Anderson. This is Mott Brown, and I have in the studio with me Ted Slater.
Hey there, Mott.
Hey, Ted.
You're doing a great job. Keep it up.
Thank you. Steve Waters.
Hey, Mott. I miss the cutest sides that Lisa would give at this point, though.
I know. I know. We all miss Lisa. But you know what? It was sort of her fault that she's not here, so I don't feel too badly for her.
So I mean, you know, if you're going to fly to Minnesota this time of year, just go ahead and plan a few extra days to stay. You know?
That's right. I think they're getting, they have 13 inches of snow last night is what she wrote this morning.
Crazy.
And we have Suzanne Hadley. Hey,
Hi,
Suzanne.
Matt. Yeah, I made welcome. It out of the Portland snow this weekend, but barely made it in, actually.
Yeah, and does it snow often in Portland?
No, it doesn't. Yeah. This was a record breaker for 40 years.
Mm. Well, we're happy you're here. Now, Suzanne is the editor of Clubhouse Junior and frequent Boundless contributor, both the website and the blog. So it's great to have Suzanne here. Today, we're going to be talking about New Year's resolutions. And fitting with that, we have an interview with Chantel Hobbs, who wrote the book Never Say Diet. And, you know, it's interesting that New Year's resolutions are all about reading books and dieting. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've had reading on my New Year's resolutions for the last 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm hoping that Chantel's book is for guys, too, because I look like Will Ferrell with my shirt off.
So our resolution is reach for a book instead of a Twinkie.
Or read something while you're on your exercise bike.
Yeah.
There you go.
And we also have John Thomas this week with Hungry Years, called Sophomore Smackdown. And for our inbox, we have a guy who wrote in asking what to do when your girlfriend is worried that you're only interested in her beauty. All right, so Steve's going to answer that one. I'm going to be with Steve on that. So let's just go ahead and jump right into New Year's resolutions. Now, Steve, I know that you don't like the term New Year's resolutions. Is that right? Are you like goal setting?
I was reading this guy who talks about the way resolutions typically play out. He said you make your resolutions in like late December or January when you feel a certain way. But at the end of the day, your January or December self has to meet your February or March self where you're really a different person. He said so you feel well-fed late December, you feel like you've spent all you could ever afford to spend, and you say, no more. I'm not going to spend another dollar. I'm not going to eat another piece of food. And it's easy to say that in the moment.
Yeah.
But then when you meet that February, March self that's saying, I'm hungry and I want that, then it's a smackdown.
Well, I wonder if it's like you indulge in December or November knowing that you're going to start all over in January.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
There's a date, it's either March or February, that's considered one of the most depressing days of the year. And it's because the winter days are still dark, but your bills have come from the holidays. You've already broken all your New Year's resolutions, and it's cold, and you're frustrated. Now, you know, that's if you don't live in Hawaii or Australia or somewhere that's nice that time of year. But that's the person that you should keep in mind as you begin making plans this time of year, knowing that you're eventually going to hit that spot. And so the last thing you want to do is have this big laundry list of resolutions that you're going to feel even more depressed about breaking. Instead of just having a bunch of resolutions, maybe just have some goals and priorities and start small and just make some progress that you can have some confidence in, not something that you feel chained down to.
Sounds like a word game, Steve. You resolve to have semantics. Some goals.
I'm just saying go into it realizing you are going to meet your February or March self, and it's going to be very different from who you are now.
Yeah, that's more appealing to people like me. I've never set New Year's resolutions. I just haven't done that. I'm more of a survivor.
But isn't it fun at this time of year though to think, okay, what could 12 months from now look like? What could I be looking back on and say, wow?
I think it's fun just to be surprised at what happens 12 months
okay,
from
so
now.
Okay, so we've got a serendipitous crowd here versus a goal setting crowd.
My resolutions are more about not doing things than doing things. Mm. And maybe I don't know, maybe that's a problem. Like I think about the year ahead, and I look at reducing the time I watch television or the time I spend on the internet, and especially this year with the kids I'm adopting, it's going to be very busy. So I'm looking to do more around the house to help my wife and just to sort of shed those time-consuming, brainless pursuits. So that's sort of what I'm looking forward to. But those could be New Year's resolutions as well, right?
Well, and Mike, you're talking specifically about routine-type things. Mm-hmm. And really, adjustments you can make in your routine are probably the most likely to affect your overall year. Because those big goals, like, I want to go to Europe this year, or I want to make $1 million or whatever, if they're not plugged into your routine somehow, they're probably not going to happen. But little things you can do in terms of how you spend your morning, how you spend your evening, how you spend your weekends are more likely to add up over the course of the year, especially if you do them long enough, they become a habit. Yeah, those great. Are the things you look at the end of the year and you go, man, I read a lot more than I thought I would. I watched a lot less television than I thought I would. I saved a lot more money than I thought I would by making these changes to my weekly routine.
Yeah. Well, let's look back on this past year. I'd like to hear from each of you on what you accomplished, if you stuck to your New Year's resolutions from last year, and what you're planning for this coming year.
Well, my wife had a New Year's resolution for me, and and that was for me to get some more exercise. And so she challenged me, and I ignored her, and so she started praying for me. And then, poof, there I was. I got a membership at the local place, and I've been working out there and swimming and stuff, so that's... maybe I should resolve to continue that the coming year.
Yeah, you've stuck to it, huh?
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
What about you, Suzanne?
Oh, I had a list of 11 resolutions ranging from use my French press to take vitamins to finish a book proposal. And as I'm looking back on them, I'm noticing the more specifically measurable ones were the ones I didn't do as well on. Mm. Whereas the cook more... Of course I cooked more. I actually did. I did. I got together with a friend once a week and we would cook a meal together. So that was good. Kind of like what you were talking about, working it into the routine. So yeah, that one worked out. But some of the ones that were a little bit more specific, I didn't accomplish. But I still have 2 days left.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
It's time to whip out the French press tonight.
Actually, I've tended to be a resolve as you go kind of person. So kind of what Steve was saying, I think that it's helpful to not just make all of your resolutions in January because they can be reactionary. Mm. In fact, there's something on here I saw, learn to play the guitar, and I think I pretty much lost interest in that in January. Uh-huh. But I did run a half marathon this year, which wasn't on my list. So that just came up in May. I decided I wanted to do that. So I think it's good to make resolutions as you go because things will come up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Candace and I made some resolutions this past year. One was to write our book, which we kind of had to do because you get a deadline from a publisher and it's an extra incentive to finish it. But also we for the past couple of years have had this resolution that we're going to finally have clear financial decks, that we're going to get out of all of our consumer debt and education debt. But kind of getting back to this idea of being flexible, we also... in the middle of trying to fulfill that goal, found out that we were expecting another baby. And so the money that was going to go to get out of debt, we realized we needed to finish our basement. And so those are the things where you go into the year with kind of a big, big goal, a big hope, big priority, but you're also flexible. And you realize, okay, I'm going to hold this against opportunities that come down the pike. And so we were glad we were flexible about that because now we have rooms for all the kids we have. And like I said, glad that we were able to finish the book. So going into this next year, the resolution is we actually use the vacation time that got sucked up in writing a book last year to go do all the hikes and trips to the national parks and things we couldn't do this past year.
Schedule that for February or March.
Well, that's not hard to do. It's something I enjoy getting away and doing. It's just a matter of prioritizing to say our family time is going to be used this way instead of getting sucked up in a bunch of side projects again, if we can help it.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate your insights on New Year's resolutions.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And, you know, I should have added the book that I finished. I do hope to sell a million copies this year. So if our listeners could
Did you give us the name of the book?
Multiple copies. Start Your Family, Inspiration for Having Babies, which just might be a resolution for some of our married listeners.
So Steve's book comes out January 1st, so I think it would be a great New Year's resolution to go buy that book and start your family.
There you go.
Seeking to be found among the sons of confidence. We're coming round now, eternity appears, the blazing sun of all humanity. All that you promised, it's ever drawing near. Each day in faith I'll rise to sing, so far above my highest dream.
For this week's culture segment, we have another special guest with us, this time around on a topic that we actually haven't dealt with here on The Boundless Show, primarily because maybe everyone on our team just wants to avoid it. And I am in the studio with Chantel Hobbs. She came all the way from the East Coast, from Florida, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And she's a little bit chilly. We had very nice weather yesterday and you missed it. And so
I was here.
Oh, you were here.
Yeah, I was.
Okay.
I was. I got here and I was like, oh, this is beautiful. And then the cold hit.
Exactly. So that is Colorado for you. But anyway, Chantel is the author of Never Say Diet. I'm just going to throw out Chantel Hobbs. That's H. Well, actually, I should spell her first name, too. That's Chantelhobbs.com. We're going to learn a little bit about her story today because she is one of those transformational stories. We'll obviously be talking about the outside, but I certainly want to get to the what was driving that and what you've learned from it,
sure,
too. But her book is called Never Say Diet. And given the fact that we are now in the midst of the season when everyone loathes to talk about this subject, but knows that they need to and knows,
sure,
that they want to and want to make significant changes in their own life, we're going to delve into this. And we do not have, as when Candace and I sometimes, we tackled a question from a listener one time dealing with appearance and food and weight and stuff. And Candace and I'm going to confess to you, Chantel, each ate a donut in celebration of that question.
You did?
We did.
Wow, that's pretty transparent of you.
It was, and, you know, we haven't made huge strides since that, but Candace had a baby, so she has an excuse, and I just sit here.
How long ago?
Oh, like, what, a week ago?
Oh, good.
Yeah, 6 days ago, so okay. small baby. Yeah, so, but anyway, welcome, all that
well,
to say.
Well, thank you.
Welcome,
well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. And there are no donuts in the studio, I might add.
There are no donuts. We may,
no,
get crazy and grab a couple.
No, we are not having a donut during this. You're free to do what you want once I leave. However, I don't feel comfortable with that while I'm here.
We're going to get crazy and maybe break out some water in a few minutes. We'll see what we do. But Chantel, just why don't you start out by really laying the groundwork for us with your story and how it led you to write the book, obviously.
Well, my deal is this. I struggled with my weight for a long time since I was a little girl. I mean, even second grade, I thought, oh, I'm bigger than everybody else. I'd say to my mom, should I be on a diet? And nobody wants to tell your child they need to be on a diet, you know, at 10 years old. Mm-hmm. But I continued to struggle with my weight really all through my teen years. And I would try different things and make a few strides, like you were saying, where I'd lose 20, 30 pounds, but I would always rebound. I had never really gotten to the end of my rope where I was willing to deal with the fact that I had an issue. I had a compulsive issue when it came to eating and food, period. And finally, I ended up marrying my high school sweetheart at 22 years old when we got married. 21, I'm sorry. But I started our family. We started our family about 6 months after we were married. We did not, you know, it was one of those things like, wow, we're starting our family already. But we had three children and during the course of my 20s. And I kind of just put my weight issue on hold. You know, it was always something. You know how it's always something for people? It was always like, oh, I'm pregnant again. I don't have to lose weight now because I'm pregnant. Mm-hmm. Finally, at 29 years old, I was all alone in my car one night. And I was driving home from my church. And I just cried out to God. I had had lots of things happen those couple of months prior to that that had hurt me. You know, either a friend saying something that they thought was out of love, but I took offense to it. The thing about being in pain when it comes to your self-esteem is you're very sensitive. I was highly sensitive. I was always offended. Do you know what I'm talking about? When people say, I'm always offended. Well, that night in the car, I cried out and I just said, God, I'm done. Like literally, it was like that feeling of, if I died right now, I would be free. That's how I felt. And I said, Lord, I'm done. Like, I am done with this pain. I am tired of being judged. I am tired of walking on an airplane and feeling like everybody's looking, thinking, please don't let her sit next to me. That's how I felt. I always felt that way. And I wanted to be free from that prison that I was living in. So I cried out and I said, Lord, I need your help here. What am I going to, you know, what can I do here? I am completely, I've tried every diet, every program, every plan, every pill, you name it, I've done it. And I heard the voice of God say to me as clear as I could possibly even begin to explain to you, you're not being the best you can be. And it was over and over again, you're not being the best you can be. And it was for the first time in all of those years of my life, with all of that struggle, with all of that pain, that I grasped the fact that loving God was not because I was choosing to love him. He loves me first, not because of how much I weigh or what I look like. And now, as I grasp that love, I can live better and be better. And it's not about, you know, losing 30 pounds in 30 days. It's about wanting to honor him with my body and take care of it. It began with really a romance with the Lord that night.
Okay. So how did that decision then translate into
play action out
that was different?
Because people are listening. People are listening. They're thinking, that's really nice that you prayed. And I'm now supposed to believe that I can pray too and lose 200 pounds or 20 pounds or whatever the case may be.
Exactly. Well, and I think that a lot of people approach weight loss similar to how many people approach faith. And it becomes almost a legalism. And it becomes, if I just do this and this and this. I mean, and for you, it sounds like there was definitely a spiritual component to it and a surrendering and an aspect that went far beyond just what you were going to do to transform your actual physical body. So talk to us about what had to happen within you in order to accomplish that.
The book is called Never Say Diet, but the subtitle is Make Five Decisions and Break the Fat Habit for Good. I had to make five decisions, and those five decisions were the core of the change that brought about, you know, this program that I came up with that's in the book that I used myself. And the first decision was I had to be truthful. And that meant, number one, I had to lay it out there, be willing to be honest that I had a weight issue, that I had a weight issue wherever it came from, because there are people that are going to listen to this broadcast, and I believe that they've got a weight issue for maybe a different reason than I did, whether it be, you know, from just relationships gone bad and they turned to food for comfort, or whether, you know, it could be something like mine where you had had it for your entire life, or maybe, you know, you did just have a baby and you're struggling with trying to get off the weight that it was extra that maybe you shouldn't have gained, but you did. Whatever the case may be, honesty, truthfulness was the first thing to begin that process for me or for anybody struggling with an addiction. So I had to be truthful. The second one, big, I had to be forgiving. I was still holding all of my old failures against myself. I would start out saying, okay, today's the day. I'm going to do this time. But I would always have my foot out the door. It was kind of like, well, I'm going to give it my best shot. I had to get over the old failures. The fact that every January 1st, for as long as I could remember, I was going to lose weight and I had never done it. I had to forget about it that day. I had to forget. The third decision was I had to be committed. And that meant there was work involved. It wasn't just going to be simply, I'm going to pray a special prayer and lose weight. I had to be committed to the work. It was Chantel that had to get on the treadmill. Chantel had to get on the recumbent bike. Chantel had to put the fork down. The fourth decision was I had to be interested. And that meant I had to have knowledge, learn how my body actually is rigged, how it works. The fifth decision was the biggest one of all, because I could lose weight doing a lot of things, but I had to be guaranteed I wouldn't go back down that road again because I was tired. I was weary. I had been in bondage. And that was like you had just said a second ago. It was surrender. The fifth decision was to be surrendered. So I had to be truthful, be forgiving, be committed, be interested, and be surrendered. I laid it down that night in the car and I said, Lord, I don't want to revisit this pain ever again. And I will do whatever it takes and I will show up. But please take this from me tonight, today. I want to be done with it. I was done with it that night. Mm-hmm. And that began the change, that began the program that I started right after that.
Mm-hmm. So did you look at it incrementally then? You didn't, you know, I think there seem to be so many different approaches. Some people say, you know, you need to look at this goal and break it down into pieces. Some people say you just need to, you know, take a small goal at a time. What did it look like as far as?
Well, I came in from the car that night, my encounter with the living God, when I said, I'm done. And I woke up my husband and I said, all right, so this is the deal. I'm going to lose all this weight. And in fact, God just showed me I'm going to write books to help people because I know there are people that are suffering like me and they don't know they can be free. I'm talking like I've already lost the weight to my husband. Mm-hmm. But remember, I'm 350 pounds. And he looks at me and he goes, babe, I believe you. He goes, but do it, then talk. Because to him, it was a serious thing. Like, you're saying God's told you this. You really maybe should get some results first. So I woke up the next day thinking, what has happened? What have I said? And I thought, I am going to start this journey today, but how do I do it, Lord? I need your help. And that, you know, brought about this program where I said, okay, every time I started to lose weight in the past, and lots of people are going to relate to this, I tried to do everything a day. I would go from this non-fit, non-regimented person who ate whatever I wanted when I wanted to, all of a sudden it's Monday, and now I make choices of only salad with chicken and exercise 2 hours a day. By Wednesday, it was brownies, you know, for breakfast. Mm-hmm. I began that first month with just a commitment to discipline, to showing up. 30 minutes a day of movement, that's it for 1 month. And that way I would build the foundation of discipline that would give me more strength to be able to resist the temptation of, you know, desires for food at different times in the future. So I showed up every single day for 30 minutes and it was feasible. It was something that I could measure. At the end of that month, I was just so proud that I'd done something I said I was going to do. Mm-hmm. It wasn't this crazy thing. It wasn't 2 hours a day. It wasn't, you know, giving up every cookie in sight. It was just 30 minutes a day. And that's the beginning of the program.
That's good. Yeah, I think that is true. So many people take on things. First of all, I think what we're getting at is that you can't really accomplish something like this in your own strength. Right. First of all, and then two, you know, you need to not over project or over. I know in the past I've done that. You know, I'll say I'll come off of, you know, 2 years of being sedentary, and I'm like, well. What I need to do is next month, I'm going to sign up for this triathlon and do this triathlon. And I'm like, you know, I hadn't, you know, run a mile in, you know, since high school or something like that. So I think that in the people that I've seen, that's been so key is doing something that you know, takes you incrementally through things. You're committing to things that you know you can keep initially and not punishing yourself for the smaller failures almost.
Well, and I think it's good for people to think of it like this. You're building a foundation to live upon for the rest of your life. It's biblical. Mm-hmm. You know, the Bible talks about in Matthew building a house upon the rock or building it on the sand. Mm-hmm. All the diets I had done to me mentally, I was building it on sand. I was always kind of trying. I was, you know, doing my best, but I would sink like 2 seconds later. Mm-hmm. This was a foundation that I wanted to stand on forever. So I had to build it from the ground up and know that it might take a little bit longer. It might require, you know, different things from me from a time perspective, but it was going to be okay because it would stand. And still, you know, now I'm sitting here with you 8 years later, and this is my life. Like, mm-hmm. It's not something I have to be worried about or fearful. That's not that person. There is still scars that I get from that person, and I'm able to relate to other people, the pain of just experiencing what I went through. But I can tell you that God has healed so much of my life just from me being willing to give it up, to be done running the show. Mm-hmm. That's the initial thing when it comes to your weight, is that if you have always thought of it as, I need a new diet, I need a new pill, I need a new whatever, I believe that's the wrong approach. I believe the right approach is saying, let me work from the inside out. Let me be willing to yield my will, my flesh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or to make it all about the number. You know, I know so many women that it's just about the number, to the point where, you know, they're in Weight Watchers and they're removing jewelry, you know, prior to their weigh-in.
Flip-flops.
Because it's just so...
Flip-flops. I've seen people take the flip-flops
headbands.
Off. I've been the girl to take the flip-flops off at the scale. The flip-flops.
Yeah.
How much could a flip-flop weigh? 4 ounces? Something the scale probably wouldn't have even measured?
Because by not having the flip-flops on, you look thinner. And
everybody will clap and hug me. And that makes me feel good.
Exactly.
So it became me.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk for a minute here about emotional eating, because for some folks, I think like with me, my deal is bad habits. I just have bad habits. I don't think, I don't plan, I don't do whatever. The next thing I know, I'm just out eating out with friends, you know, X number of times a week. Way too many times, FYI, confession, write that down. I know people who really struggle with emotional issues surrounding food that started in childhood. And it's almost
comfort.
And I've had people describe it almost as a bondage where they know that that's the first thing they run to. What are really some steps or some encouragements, Chantel, for people that deal with that?
It's a perspective issue. My program's called The Brain Change Within Never Say Diet, because I believe your brain has to change. You have to start looking at food differently. During a season of weight loss, and this is not how I look at food today, I want you to know that. But during that time, food had to get a little boring in my life, because I had, you know, become way too in love with food once I had that weight issue. There are people that may be listening and they don't have per se a weight issue, but they also are way too in love with food. Anything that you have placed to that point where you don't have control over it, whether it's your golf game, whether it's your clothing, whether it's your job, whether it's a relationship that you're in right now, if that's getting in the way of your relationship with God, or it's something that's causing you to not have self-control over, you might have to go through a season of deprivation, a season of just pruning. That's what it is. Emotional eating is so real. A lot of people will find that eating gives them comfort, makes them feel happy. The problem is it's fleeting. Mm-hmm. And that's where the weight problem comes, because it's like, well, the ice cream tastes really good and I feel better when I get to pick it and I sit down with that spoon. But 12 bites later, you felt happy during the 12 bites, but you want to keep feeling that good. And that's where it becomes 80 bites, you know, and then it's like a half
and
a gallon.
It's a lust, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lust.
It's just an unhealthy love. Mm-hmm. But the thing about food that's different than everything else is that it's God-given. Mm-hmm. We need it to operate.
Right.
So it's not that we can't love food. It's just that we need to love food properly.
Right.
I love food. I mean, there's nothing wrong with food. I love a brownie. Yeah. Like I do. It's nothing wrong with that. Don't tell me there is, because there's not.
Amen, sister.
Amen.
Okay.
Preach it.
Well, and that actually reminds me of something that you said, I think is so true as far as a practical thing that I found helpful. And that is, when you are entering that season of needing to kind of break bondage, you know, towards food, there's nothing wrong with eating things, like eating healthy things, like the same things often.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm like, unless you're Oprah and you have a personal chef, you don't have the time or the money know-how. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I bought one of Rosie, you know, her chef or whatever. I bought one of her cookbooks. Like, I am serious. I didn't even have half of the cookware that you needed to make this stuff. I didn't even know what half the ingredients were. They're like, you know, pick this off your organic farm, whatever. I'm like, I can't do this stuff.
When you become more food obsessed, trying to be not obsessed with food.
Yeah, exactly.
Inside the book, during the actual program, there's a month that I actually call it Make Food Boring. And I have you make a list of your top 10 vegetables, your top 10 fruits, your top 10 whatever. Because once you get that list, that's all that you should be eating from so that you don't have to think about it anymore. Now food is not ruling your brain and you're able to just kind of eat more as a source of fuel.
Right.
And that's a cool thing. And you don't have to count calories either, because once you've kind of already figured out that turkey sandwich with the lettuce, the tomato, the whatever is 300 calories, then it's just have the same turkey sandwich. You don't have to worry about what you're eating, how many calories are in it, because you're eating the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Yeah. So what do you think are some of the biggest mistakes that people are making out there today, Chantel, based on all the quote unquote diets that are available? And then really, I mean, obviously you're saying, you know, simplifying is key, but why are there so many different things out there? And why do so many people try all these different trendy things? You know, you've got the low carb, the no carb, you've got the, you know, the Sonoma diet and all this stuff. Like what, you know, how do you cut through the clutter and just realize...
Well,
what's
number
good,
one,
what's
we have to
there's
recognize...
Because there's so many churches, too. I mean, you got all these church programs and stuff,
Well,
too.
And we have to recognize that the diet industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. They need you to need them, which means that they don't mind confusing you. That's kind of their role. If they confuse you, you have to keep coming back because you're confused. You need an answer. For me, I want to be that source of hope. I want to say, listen, if I could lose 200 pounds, you can lose 20. But I want to know that when I share my story and when I give somebody my program, I want to know that they are grasping the fact that they are really turning over their life to the living God. Like, this is not about them anymore. This is about just saying, you know what? I don't have to have food control me. I don't have to have anything control me but the Lord. Mm-hmm. Once you get to that place, I think you can cut through a lot of the clutter. I believe that there are other things, you know, that I've read as well that I think are nutritionally sound. But the bottom line is getting back to the basics, really. If anything's telling you to go without healthy food that God's given us, as far as vegetables go, fruit go, nuts, things that God has clearly given us, if it tells you those are not a good idea, I don't have to question that, period. Mm-hmm. Like, I really don't. Other than that, anything that involves you having things delivered, mm-hmm. anything, you know, that's just not a realistic way to live. Mm-hmm. I read about this thing, and it was an infomercial. I was in a hotel one night, and I tell you what, I'm reading it, and I'm what they're saying on the screen, and I'm listening to everything they're saying. And I'm like, this really sounds interesting. You know how the infomercials, mm-hmm. they suck you in. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, based on what I do, I wanted to look it up. I go online, and this is the great thing. They will provide food for you, and, like, they believe you should be eating eggs and all that, but mm-hmm. not just eggs that they send to you. Mm. So you can buy a month's worth of your daily eggs for $32.
Whoa.
Eggs. Eggs.
Wow.
To me, I thought, how could I need to buy eggs from you and have them sent from some warehouse somewhere? That's the kind of stuff we don't really have to wonder or pray about. Like, that's just an obvious thing.
Yeah.
Just make sure that whatever, you know, whatever you're thinking in regards to what to do next, first pray about, I believe. That's the bottom line. And believe that it's possible that you can do this. Like, you can totally have this under control. Sure. And it will make you available to other people, because you won't be living in the bondage of feeling like you're failing all the time.
Sure.
At being your best.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, so as we wrap, tell us kind of, Chantel, where you are today. Kind of, I mean, you said yourself, I mean, you were staring, you know, years ago, what would you say, 8 years ago now, mm-hmm. at 350 pounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, living a much healthier lifestyle now, looking great, totally envying your hair, by the way, FYI, you. Maybe you can talk to me about that afterwards. But anywho, you're obviously out encouraging others. I'm not just women. We always think of this as like a women's issue, but it's not.
Sure,
we
no.
have both, you know, male and female listeners, of course. But really, what kind of, how has this journey brought you hope, and kind of where do you see yourself going now with being able to give this message to others?
Well, it's really been awesome, because as I have, you know, as I lost the weight, I knew I would write a book one day. And so I had the opportunity to do that about 2 years ago. And that was where I began to write that book, and then it, you know, has grown into some other things. But now I've got a music project going, and I've been working in Nashville, and I'm got music coming out that's to help people move, because I believe that it's good to have music with great lyrics that helps people move. So I'm just all about trying to keep people focused on, number one, receiving the love of God, implementing that into your life, and being the best you can be. So wherever that takes me, I'm excited to watch, and it's taking me some crazy places. I mean, I will wake up some days and just think, this is amazing to me. I mean, yes, I have ran 5 marathons. Like, I was 350 pounds, and to run 26.2 miles was crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was crazy. But that's like old news. That's like, oh, okay, that's great. I can, that's something I've done. I just want every day to be the best, you know, and I'm excited to have more peak moments. There's mm-hmm. been lots of them along the way. And I think that I had had too few of them at that point I was at. We define those peak moments by, like, you know, the day you graduate school, the day that you win the softball tournament, whatever the case may be, or, you know, for some people, it's the day they have their baby, the day they get married, graduate college. But you can have them all the time. And I want to encourage people, that's what my goal is. Like, that's what I seek to do all the time, to have those peak moments. But now, as I get emails, as I've, you know, been able to watch lots of other people hear my story and be inspired, I'm very humbled by that, to think that God took the greatest source of pain in my life and has now given me this voice and this platform and this opportunity to tell people that you don't have to suffer. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you don't. You can be free. Mm-hmm. I was definitely a captive, mm-hmm. who was in prison, and now I'm free. Mm-hmm. And that's the message that I want people to hear. Jeremiah 29.
Yay. Well, and I think it's neat, because I think it does inspire people to realize that there is hope beyond that weariness of just feeling like they're struggling, yes. and they can't get their head above the water, and there's no way that they'll ever have victory over this or be able to live a life free from a bondage to food or to whatever, you know, whatever they may be struggling with. So I think that's fantastic. Okay, the website is chantelhobbs.com. Again, that's chantelhobbs. Check it out. And her book is Never Say Diet. We're so
Thank
glad
you.
That you came to Colorado.
Lovely to meet
to visit
you.
Us.
Here's John Thomas with this week's The Hungry Years Sophomore Smackdown.
Some college roommates are assigned randomly by computers, and I've had my share of those, but Mitch and I came together by a pre-college friendship, having met at summer camp during our high school years. One particular Saturday back at school, Mitch and I had returned early from Christmas break, and the campus was a ghost town. We sat in our duplex apartment, our eyes glazed and brains numbed in a music television stupor. I had melted into the couch, teetering on coma, and Mitch was splayed out on a chair. A visitor might have mistaken us for corpses, were it not for the pooling drool under my cheek and for Mitch's right foot planted on his skateboard like a four-wheeled ottoman, slowly rolling back and forward under the hardwood living room floor. The thing was talking to him. He suddenly woke up from his trance and bolted upright. "Hey, let's skateboard down that closed water slide on College Street." In my brain fog, I agreed and soon found myself at the top of a waterless water slide, the precipice of my own X game, staring down a labyrinth of pale blue concrete spirals, a metaphor for my new impulsive lifestyle, seizing the moment, leaping into the unknown. I volunteered to go first, my thinking clouded due to my pituitary not being used to regulating much adrenaline, a poster child for protective headgear. The route started with a straight stretch, a low-grade descent for about 30 feet, then pulled a short turn to the right, then straight for a few more feet, and then a hard left. The G's were picking up as I lay back through the second turn and made my way down off the wall into the center of the slide. I had reached that speed that was too fast for an intentional fall for emergency stoppage, but was also much faster than I'd ever gone or ever wanted to go. A metaphor, maybe, but on steroids. It was about right here that I realized this day wouldn't end without an awkward phone call to my parents. I shifted my weight to prepare for the next turn and encountered what no skateboard has ever survived, a well-placed piece of gravel. I stopped dead on a dime and couldn't get a single appendage out in front of my face before the unforgiving law of gravity overtook my head and slammed it into the water slide. This was the pre-helmet era of wheeled recreation. Fortunately, though, my lips, nose, and teeth softened the blow for my forehead, so there was little or no brain damage, no more than what apparently already existed. Mitch ran down to the scene of the accident. "Oh, my gosh, that's not good. Whoo, man, you're bleeding all over your shirt." Mitch sprang into action, ignited by some premature dad reflex. He made all the necessary phone calls, gave all the proper information, and got me to the dentist. There was a good chance he would buy me ice cream when this was all over. I blanked out for a bit, and when I came to, I was staring into a blinding light. I tried to make out the blurred figure staring down at me. Yes, my great cloud of witnesses. This must be it. I'm crossing over. I wouldn't have to make that awkward phone call to my parents after all, although I didn't envy the call Mitch would have to make to them. "Oh, man, that looks bad." It was Mitch, his face panned left into my field of vision, blocking the light, forcing an adjustment of my eye aperture to make room for his 6'3 frame. Many times I'd envision what my rival in glory might be like, but none of my scenarios figured the pearly gates manned by Mitch. Oh, I hadn't died. The phone call was back on. "Dude, your tooth went right through your lip, then swung backwards, hinge-like. The doctor's gonna try to push it back into place." The doctor returned and opted for the old-fashioned approach of fixing teeth. He stuffed his entire hand into my mouth and with much grinding and crunching wedged my tooth into its proper position. This was a perfect time for one of those out-of-body experiences I'd heard so much about. You know, someone reaching out to me, telling me to take his hand and walk toward the light. I would have been happy just to faint. Somehow, I survived. For several weeks, I bore on my face the marks of that day, which faded over time. But the memory of the adventure and countless others with Mitch, not all of them so hazardous, sticks with me even 20 years later. He had a gift for identifying the things that would confront my courage deficiency and, with each new experience, helped me face down a little more fear. Thankfully, not every experience required medical attention, but a lot of them did force me to grow, to change, even to trust. Those adventures occasionally re-enter my consciousness when I'm faced with some new or difficult challenge in my life, and I'll think, I can do this. I'm the guy that stood at the top of the water slide, the guy who looked fear in the face and said, "Bring it on." The one who pushed off with abandon, who turned two curves and reached dangerous speeds with the courage of a pro. And then I put on a helmet, I grab a broom, and I sweep up the gravel. Metaphorically speaking, of course.
Welcome, Steve, to this week's Inbox. We have a great question, interesting question from a guy who's dating a girl long distance. They met online, but he says that's another story. And let me just go ahead and read Andrew's question. My girlfriend lives far away from me. I haven't had a chance to meet her yet, but I've seen many pictures. I know with all my heart that she is beautiful, and I tell her this several times a day because she is. But she says to me now and then that she thinks I care for her only because of her beauty, that I really don't love her for who she is. I tell her all the time that while I do love her beauty, I love her honesty, her love for children, her willingness to have fun at any time, among other things. But still she says she wishes she wasn't so beautiful, asking, "Would you still love me if I weren't beautiful?" I really don't know what to do, how to answer her, or convince her that she truly is beautiful in other ways. It just doesn't seem to do anything but bounce off of some wall she has built up. Thank you for any advice. Steve?
Might I like this question because I appreciate his heart, his desire to have a more well-rounded approach to this girl, to not just see her for her appearance. And it's interesting that she's actually the one who's pushing on that, who is trying to discern how much more he cares about than her beauty. And, you know, we've all heard that beauty fades in 100% of women. And because of that, it can't be the most pressing thing about a relationship, that you really do have to love somebody body, mind, and spirit, and that you do want to plan on growing old with somebody that you appreciate even as their body does change and they lose that freshness of youth. And to be frank, the reality is, the possibility is, in an online world, you never know whose picture she's in. And so I want to hope the best in this situation, that this guy's not getting pictures slipped to him that don't represent who he's really interacting with.
You think that could be why she's so concerned about it?
It just might be, because okay, she's going to spring load her real pictures on him any day now. No, seriously, I mean, we're hoping that this guy is getting pictures of her, and maybe she really is beautiful, and she wants to know that he does see beyond her appearance. And a lot of guys don't. I mean, a lot of guys are hooked into a relationship by the appearance of someone, and then they tolerate all kinds of character flaws otherwise. And so I really appreciate that he's looking beyond that. But as he's trying to convince her that he sees beyond that, I think a couple of things he can keep in mind. One is that he can ask her, are there attributes about you that you're worried I'm overlooking? Are there characteristics that you feel like I should be seeing that I'm not, that, mm-hmm. that I'm distracted by your appearance instead? And secondly, to be praying, to say, God, help me see this girl as you see her. Help me to see her mind, body, and spirit.
Yeah.
To see the whole person in case there's something I'm overlooking. But the other advice we always give here at Balance, I think, is even more valuable in this situation because of the distance, because of the fact they haven't met in person, which is having some other people in their lives, some friends, some family, some mentors, somebody who's able to give some additional advice. And maybe even ask her to say, are there friends or family members that I could correspond with who could help me get a better picture of who you are and what other things we should be developing and enjoying in this relationship.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I wonder if the distance is part of the problem here, that there's some insecurity because you can't get to know someone as deeply as you would if you were spending more time with them. I mean, he's never even met her.
Yeah.
So I think that could be an insecurity on her part.
Well, and too, I mean, anybody who has met online but hasn't met in person yet always wonders when they actually physically meet, will the whole package work? Because those pictures typically are the most flattering pictures somebody has of themselves. And they're going to see things about that person that aren't quite as polished and put together as the online persona. And so I think there is a desire to know there's some depth beyond those superficial interactions. And so that's where I think those prayers and the extended relationships that help them get a bigger picture of that relationship and that person would help go beyond those superficial pieces.
And I think part of the problem could be him. I mean, he confesses in the letter, in the question, that he tells her she's beautiful several times a day. And that can be a good thing, but I think he needs to examine himself to see whether or not he is just so captivated by her beauty that he is overlooking other attributes.
Yeah, I was just reading the Proverbs 31 woman passage again this morning. It was the one-year Bible reading for the day from Proverbs. And it's just a reminder of just how well-rounded a solid biblical wife is, and that her beauty is a part of what God has brought into that relationship, but to be able to see all those other characteristics that really are the things that matter once beauty fades. And if he reads that passage and then begins asking God, is this a Proverbs 31 woman? Are those characteristics there, and can I be praising her for those? I think that would help her as well. If she really has those characteristics but feel like he's been focused more on her appearance, then her willingness to be the full-fledged, well-rounded, godly woman that she is.
That's great. Well, thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Mike. It's a good opportunity.
Yeah, that'll wrap it up for this week's Boundless Show. Thank you for listening. Please tell your friends about us. This is fill-in host Mott Brown. And please write us if you have any questions or comments at editor@boundless.org.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focused on the family.